Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we look at Canada and the United Nations with Alan Rock. As listeners know, Canada is seeking a temporary seat on the UN Security Council with the vote to take place later this week. And I would encourage you to read Andrea Charron's excellent primer on the election that is available on our website. But this podcast is about Canada and the United Nations, and I'm delighted that Alan can join us today. Alan, welcome.
Thank you, Colin.
For listeners, Alan's distinguished parliamentary career, in which Mr. Rock served as justice and then health minister in the Chrétien government, was then, after that, he was appointed and served as Canada's ambassador to the United Nations from 2004 to 2006. After his posting, he served as president and vice chancellor of the University of Ottawa, and he is now their president emeritus. As ambassador to the UN, Alan was an advocate of human rights, human security, and reforming the United Nations. He led the successful Canadian effort to secure the adoption by world leaders of the doctrine Responsibility to Protect that maintains that the United Nations is mandated to protect populations from genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, and crimes against humanity when national governments fail to extend such protection or are themselves engaged in such crimes against their own people. He also led efforts at development in Haiti to end the conflict in northern Uganda and peace between Sudan and Darfur. Alan, our listeners can learn a lot about the UN from your experience. So let me start with this question. What does the ambassador and his team do, and how do we advance Canadian objectives? And if you want to use R2P as an example, that's great. But more about, you know, when you're there, how do you decide what you're going to do, and how do you get it done?
Well, first of all, let me speak generally, Colin, about the mandate of the Canadian mission to the UN in New York. And then I'll say a few words more specifically about the special campaign for responsibility to protect. Generally, the objective of the Canadian mission to the UN is to represent Canada in the principal bodies of the UN. That is to say, the General Assembly, before the Security Council, the Economic and Social Council, and the committees and subsidiary bodies in the UN family of entities. We're there to promote and advance Canada's foreign policy. That is to say, what do we want to achieve as a country? And how do we best get it done? We're there to link with like-minded member states in pursuing shared objectives, working with allies to achieve common goals. We're also there to manage those countries who don't share our objectives and manage them as best we can. There's also an information gathering aspect. That is to say, what other countries are saying and doing. And there are always events and trends and risks that we report back to Ottawa. And then Foreign Affairs sort of integrates that information with its own intelligence from other sources. It's analyzed and then presented to the minister and the PM. So that they can make decisions based on real knowledge of what's happening out there. We're also there, I must say, just to add one other thing, Colin. We're there to make sure that Canada is represented on globally significant bodies. And so often there are either appointments or elections to things like the International Law Commission or other agencies or councils or commissions around the world. We're there to make sure there are Canadians nominated and supported in their campaigns so that we have a fair representation of Canadians on these critical bodies. Let me say a word about the specific campaign on R2P, as it was my privilege to be there during that period. As you may know, Canada sponsored an international commission that reported in 2001 with an answer to the age-old question, how do you square respect for state sovereignty on the one hand, and on the other, the moral imperative to intervene if the country is killing its own citizens or allowing somebody else to do so. Well, the commission that we sponsored reported that sovereignty includes responsibility, and therefore the UN should adopt as part of its mandate to intervene lawfully and properly where a sovereign state is not respecting its responsibility to protect its people. Now, the campaign really started in 2001 when that report was tabled. The government of Canada, through Global Affairs, then Foreign Affairs, convened meetings regionally throughout the world to explain the concept and to promote it. We engaged in bilateral advocacy in capitals around the world. By the time I got to New York in late 2003, early 2004, the foundation had been laid, but there was still a lot of work to do. And in the 2 years between my arrival and the global summit, when member states adopted the principle, we conducted dozens and dozens of seminars, conferences, retreats. We issued policy papers. I hosted countless dinners and lunches, convened meetings to explain and to promote the idea of responsibility to protect. It was not easy because with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, a lot of countries were allergic to the idea of giving the global north a blank check to intervene whenever the U.N. thought it was appropriate. But I must say that through putting in place building blocks like the high-level panel report in advance of the global summit, the Secretary General's own report, which he called In Greater Freedom, and then 8 months of intensive negotiations, we got it done. And a lot of that was just shoe leather diplomacy, walking to people's offices, sitting quietly with them, patiently listening to their objections, debating the merits of the proposal with them, and doing the best we could to reassure those who were skittish about an open-ended commitment to intervene whenever humanity required it.
I'm glad you went into the detail, because that's what sometimes people aren't aware of, is they sort of hear these things. But as you pointed out, this was a multi-year effort involving a whole lot of partners and many different methods to achieve. And as you point out, the Secretary General had a report and these various sessions that you held before it came. It culminated, as you pointed out, I think you said in the leaders' meeting, where there was broad adoption of this, because this is really quite a remarkable achievement, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's an achievement by the country. I mean, I'll tell you, one very dramatic event occurred. 8 months of negotiation came down to the last 24 hours when the leaders were to arrive September 14th, 2005. Their plane started landing at Teterboro Airport, and still we had no agreement. We worked until about 1 o'clock in the morning, the night before the deadline. And there were four countries that were holding out and causing real grief on the issue of responsibility to protect. I went home that night and I sent a message to the Prime Minister's office asking to speak with them first thing in the morning. I did. And I asked him to telephone the leaders of those four countries, tell them what their ambassadors were doing in case they weren't aware, and asked them to back off, because this was an important Canadian priority, and we thought it a priority for humanity. The PM made those calls, and when we reconvened, there was a noticeable change in the attitude and approach of those four ambassadors. I can tell you that they were chastened, because their leaders had spoken to them, and indeed had told them that this was a priority that their country was prepared to support. So it was an effort that involved everybody, from diplomats in our embassies and missions around the world, right through eventually to the Prime Minister of Canada, who made those critical calls at a critical time.
But you just underlined that you made the call to the Prime Minister's office to ask the Prime Minister to make the call, which I think is also important for listeners to hear, that that's what ambassadors do, and ambassadors need to have access on occasion to the Prime Minister to, indeed, as the Prime Minister then made the calls, which clearly changed the situation, because in this case, doesn't it have to be done by consensus?
Yes, in fact, it does have to be done by consensus. It was not a vote, and there was a dramatic moment in the General Assembly when, after we thought we had agreement, there was a resolution put before the General Assembly for a vote, and just before the vote was called, Venezuela, which can always be counted on under its then and present leadership to be difficult, asked for the opportunity to speak and began ranting against R2P and solicited support for that position among member states. And while they were doing that, the Cuban ambassador walked down to the Venezuelan desk in the General Assembly, interrupted the speaker, and asked to confer urgently. I saw, we all watched as they spoke animatedly. And after 5 or 10 minutes of conversation between them, Venezuela turned back on its microphone and said they were going to withdraw their proposal for opposing R2P. I later learned that what happened is that Cuba had a lot of stuff in the outcome document that it supported. It did not want to reopen the debate on many of what it thought were its achievements. So they persuaded their ideological counterpart or fellow traveler, Venezuela, to withdraw opposition and let the matter go through. But it was dramatic right to the very last moment.
I didn't know that, and that's quite remarkable. But again, you just kind of reemphasize that this was a multi-pronged effort, because I have no doubt that our ambassador in Havana would have been talking to the Cuban, and then that you would have talked to your counterpart, and that it's this multi-layers of effort that eventually have result, but it is cumulative, and it doesn't happen overnight, and in this case taking place over a number of years before culminating in that UN General Assembly resolution.
Exactly.
Now, on R2P, because sometimes it gets a bit of a bad rap of late, and I've often thought it was sometimes people misinterpret what it was an effort to do. They sort of say, oh, that means military intervention. But I thought that the emphasis was on diplomacy, influence, persuasion, advocacy, building coalitions before you got to military intervention, which in any case would have to be sanctioned by the UN, probably Security Council in any event. Is that not right?
Well, that's right. And the whole idea of R2P is to prevent, anticipate, recognize the warning signs, and then take steps to prevent mass atrocities. You know, in Rwanda, which is perhaps the most vivid recent example of a genocide, although the genocide of the Rohingya in Myanmar is equally compelling in many ways. But in Rwanda, there were many, many warning signs, Colvin. As you know, radio stations were broadcasting incitement, the most hateful language, urging violence against the tribal group that was slaughtered, the Tutsis. And this was known weeks in advance. We could see the telltale signs, and yet there was no effective collective response. In Myanmar, the military and the majority have been denying citizenship to the Rohingya, displacing them, harassing them, refusing them the right to vote or even to have rights of mobility within Burma or Myanmar. And then, of course, in August of 2017, when the violence started that led to the genocide, we had lots of notice. And then we watched it in slow motion and did nothing as a collective. So prevention, anticipating, being able to recognize the early signs of incipient atrocities, and having the moral fiber to do something about it at that stage, not sending in the military, but imposing diplomatic consequences, getting the attention of the oppressor, making sure they know that they'll pay a political, economic price for what they're doing, throwing them out of organizations or imposing sanctions, or making sure that they can't send their kids to school in England or in Canada, clamping down on the real wrongdoers. That's prevention. And of course, in the rarest case, as a last resort, there is the option of military intervention, which the International Commission said should be in the most exceptional cases. And the negotiation in which I participated in 2005 produced an outcome document that said it will be a very last resort. And R2P gets a bad rap because of Libya. You know, in 2011, with the rebellion in full force in Libya, Muammar Gaddafi threatened to obliterate an entire city, which he regarded as disloyal. And, you know, Gaddafi is, of course, was an international criminal and probably insane. So it was a credible threat that he was going to go and obliterate Benghazi. He even referred to them as cockroaches, which was the word used by the genocide in Rwanda. So this was a serious threat. And Canada joined other countries in urging the Security Council to invoke R2P and to take such steps as may be necessary to prevent that slaughter. And the Security Council adopted the resolution. It passed the task off to NATO. And NATO, then undertook the mandate from the Security Council, but there were two fatal errors in the way it was implemented. Number one, NATO didn't stop at protection. It went on to regime change, and it helped eliminate Gaddafi and his entire government. And that sort of validated the traditional criticism of R2P, that it's not about protection, it's all about regime change. Well, NATO didn't do us any favors by showing that, through its error in that regard, that there was some credence to that argument. And the second fatal error is that, yes, NATO destroyed the Gaddafi regime, but then it left. And left only rubble and smoking ruins behind, with no semblance of governance, no opportunity to protect the people. And of course, it's been a catastrophe ever since, a dreadful blight on the world, dreadful breaches of human rights, a center of terrorism and human trafficking. It's just been an awful disaster. But that's not the fault of R2P, which constitute principles that are hard to argue with. It's the fault of the manner in which it was implemented. And in fact, the Brazilian delegation to the United Nations has since introduced a resolution called Responsibility While Protecting, which is intended to ensure that should such a thing ever happen again, that there will be an explicit admonition to those who are implementing to stick with the terms of the resolution, to focus only on protection, and to not become adventurous in the manner in which the mandate is carried out. So R2P's principles are as valid and as important, and I would say as necessary as ever. And we have to overcome the damage done by the Libyan experience to restore it to its proper place as a legitimate instrument in global governance.
And I guess the good thing, I mean, yes, as you point out, the Libyan poisoned the well, but nonetheless, the effort that you and made and was endorsed by all, it still remains on the books. And as you point out, with the fact that the Brazilians offering, look, here's what we reinterpreted, that's in a sense growing the law, but at least it is now on the books. Are we not better off having put R2P through the General Assembly and having had it broadly endorsed than without it? Because at least it's there.
Well, it's there, and there's an annual debate in the General Assembly on R2P convened by the Secretary General. Support for R2P remains strong and widespread. There is a mountain of scholarship on the subject. There have been four special advisors to the Secretary General on R2P. The doctrine is now well embedded as an established norm in international law. And yes, the day will come when hopefully it will be used again. Of course, the current condition of the Security Council means that even had there been no opposition to R2P as a concept in Myanmar or elsewhere, it wouldn't have mattered, because the Security Council at the moment is so paralyzed and ineffective because of the friction among the five permanent members and the dysfunction that has caused, that nothing in any event would have been done. I mean, the Security Council can't even get together to agree on how to meet during the pandemic. That's how pathetic things have become. And that's why I so very much hope that Canada will be able to join the Council soon and try to improve the conditions there.
Well, you just point out one of the things that you also looked at, which has seemed to be almost permanent since the UN has been formed, and that's the whole idea of reform, particularly of the Security Council. What's your sense on that? Are we making progress? I realize this is a bad time, and I think as even the Secretary General Guterres said, he sort of said, look, the litmus for us is if we can actually do something around the COVID crisis. And by his own setting of standards, the Security Council has not met that. But that, as you point out, I think is a function of the current situation. How do we fix that? I mean, I'm sure this is something you probably considered when you were there.
I did. I took part in many debates about the Security Council changing the way it's constituted, the way it works. Let's face it, there are 15 members on the Security Council. 10 of them are elected for two-year terms. 5 of them are permanent. In 1945, essentially the victors of World War II were rewarded with a permanent seat on the central and most powerful body in the UN system. In many ways, that was the price that was paid by
FDR and the Americans for acceptance of the concept of the UN. The most powerful nations then in the world were guaranteed a permanent place at the center of this new UN system. But of course, it's been a curse. Anytime you hand five countries an unquestioned right to veto anything, I mean, you can't even get anything on the agenda of the Security Council unless it gets past the veto. And once it's there, it can be vetoed for any reason that need not even be stated by these five countries. So you can imagine the abuse which occurs. There have been many suggestions over the years as to how the Security Council might be reformed. First of all, to make it more representative. I mean, India, with a population of 1.1 billion people, is not even among the permanent members. And the Global South is unrepresented, and Europe is overrepresented. So if we only took a snapshot of the world in 1945 and made it a permanent feature of global governance, well, that's not legitimate, and it's not durable. So many people have suggested changes. But how can you change something when every proposal you make is subject to the veto? And the self-interest of the permanent five, or the P5, as they're called, is to perpetuate the status quo. So the focus has been on what they call working methods. Okay, if we can't change the way the council's made up, can we at least change the way it does its business so there's more openness, transparency, preparedness to accept differing views, accountability? And Canada, among others, has focused on working methods. But, you know, it's a sad substitute for real reform. Canada made a proposal when I was there, Colin, and let me just tell you briefly what it was. We suggested how the Security Council could be reformed to make it more legitimate, to make it more democratic and more representative, to make it more effective. Here's what we proposed. We proposed that there ought to be a Security Council of 15 to 20 members. You know, pick your number. And that we're gonna leave the five permanent members, okay? We know that we're not going to be able to change that, and they're going to have their vetoes. And then you add to the five permanent members, you add either 10 or up to 15 seats. They're not permanent seats in the sense that people aren't appointed or elected to those seats and remain there forever. They're distributed among the regions of the world. A given number go to Africa, to Asia, to South America, and Europe. And then the countries of those regions have the right to elect which of their member states from that region is going to occupy the designated seats and for how long. So if Africa decides that Nigeria and South Africa should be the members and they should be there for 5 years, then that's the case. If they decide that Nigeria should be there for 3 years, South Africa for 10, that should be the case. If South America says Brazil should be there for the longest because it's the largest economy, so be it. And so on around the world. So you'd have seats permanently assigned to regions, but the countries occupying those seats would be elected and would be there for periods to be determined by the countries in that region. We thought that was democratic. We thought it'd be representative, and we thought it'd be effective. But of course, it was rejected because it's a change in the status quo.
So you're not optimistic, because I know there's been various sort of ideas about adding more temporary members and variations on what you suggest with allowing some members longer terms, all of which, you know, you would think make sense. So we live with what we've got for now. Let me then shift to the General Assembly, where we are more often not on the Security Council and in the General Assembly. But it strikes me, and you've just, as we began our conversation, illustrated that even on the General Assembly, you can still accomplish a fair bit. You were able to do this. You were not a member of the Security Council in terms of advancing responsibility to protect. And I watched Highwire not too long ago, Paul Heinbecker working, again, not on the Security Council, to try and prevent the U.S. intervention in Iraq through working with other members. So it strikes me that there's still there's still a lot of scope with a creative ambassador, with the support of the prime minister, as you've just underlined, making the calls for a country like Canada to make a difference. Is that fair?
Absolutely, Colin. I just might point out Paul Heimbecker, who was one of our most effective ambassadors ever, a wonderful diplomat. Paul was on the Security Council during that period. He made heroic efforts to try to stop the Iraq war, as you saw in that fabulous documentary. But yes, even when we're not on the Security Council, just being in the General Assembly provides us with a number of great opportunities to make a difference. You know, the General Assembly has been terribly frustrated by the ineffectiveness of the Security Council in recent years. And I'll give you an example of what they can do. In the face of the Security Council's repeated refusal to take any meaningful step to try to stop the war in Syria, or to limit or even condemn the atrocities in Syria, the General Assembly introduced a resolution that created a mechanism that would gather and record evidence of those atrocities, so that when the day finally comes that those war criminals face justice, a comprehensive, reliable set of evidentiary materials will be available to be handed to the court, put into evidence in the prosecution of those accused. So, you know, sometimes the General Assembly isn't able to act directly because the charter doesn't give it the authority, but they can act indirectly to do things that make a meaningful difference. And of course, there's also the Uniting for Peace resolution concept, which was developed in the 50s, by which the General Assembly can use its enormous moral authority to make a meaningful difference in urging that steps be taken to address global emergencies. Uniting for Peace is a great mechanism that I think we should be using more aggressively and creatively, given the manifest inadequacy of the Security Council to respond to the world's needs.
And again, underlining the role of the ambassador and working through the General Assembly, which takes me to the bigger question of the value of multilateralism and the whole United Nations to Canada, that there's been some question, does this work, the frustrations which you echo and we all feel, but I'd be interested in your take. My sense is that you still see great value in multilateralism, and that Canada's participation in the UN family, that alphabet soup of agencies, really serves our interests. Is that fair?
Well, yeah, it's self-evident to Canadians, and perhaps we have difficulty understanding why it's not self-evident to everybody else in the world, that the only way we're going to muddle through with the crises and the conflicts and the problems that afflict us is by working constructively together. I mean, how do you think we're going to manage and master a global threat to public health like the pandemic? Only by collaborating and cooperating, because, you know, it's great for New Zealand to say, well, we've wiped it out, it's no longer a problem here, but they've closed their airports. You can't fly to New Zealand except if you quarantine for 14 days. So if New Zealand wants to rejoin the world, it better join the global effort to defeat it, not just there, but everywhere, because we need a world in which people can travel, see their families, conduct their business, and carry on. So my point is, multilateralism is crucial to our success as humanity. And in terms of Canada, well, it's the lifeblood of our international engagement and our role in the world. You know, as a so-called middle power, and especially a country that depends so much as we do on trade, it's very important that we be a member of every club, from NATO to the Commonwealth to APEC to the UN, to Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. We derive our influence as a country through our active and committed engagement in these organizations with others. And by the way, the currency that we bring to the table and with which we purchase a lot of our influence is the currency of ideas. Going right back to Lester Pearson and his idea of peacekeeping, But more recently, it was Canada, through the leadership of Lloyd Axworthy as foreign minister, that put human security at the center of the global agenda, where it still resides. Lloyd and people of his generation in the leadership of foreign affairs introduced the concept of the protection of civilians, of women, peace and security, children and armed conflict, and yes, R2P. And at that time, Canada also championed the idea of an international criminal court and was very instrumental in its creation. So in that way, Canada, through the multilateral system, has sometimes changed the conversation, but I think always added value. And if we have influence, it's because people recognize that we add that value. We have that currency of ideas, which has been so valuable to the world. So yes, multilateralism, I think, is fundamental if we're going to survive as a species. And for Canada, given who we are, what we are, and where our talents lie and our interests, multilateralism ought to be central to our federal government's foreign policy.
And to take it back to the domestic, it strikes me that, again, we've enjoyed broad cross-party support for multilateralism, but that's something you have to work at on a kind of daily basis. But it's also reflective of kind of what Canada itself is all about, is our identity. Is it for us to work? Multilateralism is, in a sense, how we manage the Federation.
Very much so. And I think one of the reasons we're so good at global affairs is that we have, since we began as a country, faced the challenge of managing a domestic arrangement, which in a federation means reconciling the function of one order of government with another order of government. It means accommodating differences in a common cause. It means recognizing that different levels of government have different responsibilities and making it all work together, overcoming the frictions. So we practice a lot at home, and that gives us the skill when we go abroad to recognize pathways to peace and how we might manage friction, differences, and conflict abroad. And it makes us a valuable member of that multilateral club, I can tell you.
Helen, well said. And on that encouraging note, let me ask you, what are you reading these days?
Oh, I'm very much enjoying a book called The Splendid and the Vile. It's by a man named Eric Larson. And what he's done is to take the period of May of 1940 until May of 1941 in London during the Blitz, the first year that Winston Churchill was prime minister. And, we've all read book after book about Churchill. I can't get enough of it. But we've read a lot about Churchill. But this is different, Colin, because it sort of gives a personal perspective on Churchill and his entourage during that critical year. How were they responding to the challenge? How were they dealing with the fear? How were they managing public opinion and expectations? Well, this book is just a great read. And my mother and father lived through the Blitz in London during that year. So I have sort of a personal connection to it in that sense as well. But it's also a book that tells us a lot about leadership during difficult times. And so particularly in the current global circumstances, when there's such a lack of leadership, it's great to read about a period where an individual stepped forward, assumed responsibilities, and met the challenge in the most admirable way. So it's a great book. I strongly recommend it. It's called The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. It's well worth reading.
Excellent. Perfect summer reading. Thank you, and thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by Alan Rock. Remember, you can find the CJA Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, please give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. That's where you'll see the reference to The Splendid and the Vile. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to our producer, Jay Rankin, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.